From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As head of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, Kenneth Feinberg had to place a value on life and come up with a formula to distribute over $7 billion to the victims of September 11th and the families of those who died. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about his new memoir called What is Life Worth? Also, we meet Christian Bale, the star of Batman Begins. He had to play the superhero right after having lost about 63 pounds for his role in The Machinist as a tormented insomniac. He made his film debut in his early teens, starring in Empire of the Sun. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's no way of saying what a human life is worth in dollars and cents, but that was the job my guest Kenneth Feinberg was faced with. In 2001, he was appointed by then Attorney General John Ashcroft to head the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund and oversee the distribution of about $7 billion to the surviving victims of the attacks and to the families of those who were killed. The fund, which was created by Congress, marked the first and only time that the federal government offered individuals large sums of money, tax-free, to compensate for a tragic loss. Feinberg had extensive experience as a mediator, resolving disputes between Fortune 500 companies and victims of faulty products, health hazards, fraud, and wrongdoing. Feinberg was also one of the three arbitrators selected to determine the fair market value of the original Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. Feinberg has written a new book about his experiences compensating the victims of September 11th. It's called What is Life Worth? So when you were appointed to be the master in charge of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, exactly what guidelines were you given to help you decide who should get what amount of money?
Very little. If you read the statute, it is very simple. It's one page. The Congress simply delegates to one person, the special master or the administrator, responsibility for designing the rules, administering the program, and authorizing awards. And other than a rather simple generic formula for calculating compensation in individual cases, Congress does not say one word about how it ought to be done, who should get the money, who should file the claim. All of that had to be created out of whole cloth by the special master.
Which was you.
That's right. I was appointed by the Attorney General, General Ashcroft.
So let's talk about some of the most difficult financial and ethical dilemmas that you faced in dividing up this money. First of all, how did you figure out whether you wanted to just divide it up equally among all the people who are eligible, or figure out some kind of formula to figure out who gets more and who gets less?
The statute absolutely prohibited me from dividing up an amount of money and distributing it equally. The statute said that I must first calculate the economic loss suffered as a result of the death or injury of the victim. That guaranteed a process that would require me to give more to stockbrokers and bond traders and accountants than to policemen, firemen, members of the military, busboys, or waiters. I was prohibited by statute from equal distribution of awards.
How did you feel about that? Because it's basically placing a value on a life as wage earner, as opposed to placing a value on the life as a spouse, a child, a parent.
Well, you know, juries do it every day in every city and village in our country. Juries always award more damages to the stockbroker or the bond trader than the waiter or the busboy. It's not un-American. It's done every day. Nevertheless, asking one person to calculate different awards by looking into some murky crystal ball, and then expecting the families to accept the notion that one family gets $1 million less than another family, proved to be very, very controversial and divisive. That we were able to overcome this requirement, I think, is a tribute to the fund and a tribute to the success of the fund.
You held a lot of town meetings for the families who lost loved ones on September 11th. Was there a lot of fighting among the families about this very issue, about some families getting $1 million and others getting a lot less?
Absolutely. At the beginning of the fund, after all, the fund was created within weeks after 9/11, so emotions were particularly raw at the outset. Families would object vehemently to the notion that the value of one life was calculated to be worth more than the value of another. And despite every effort that I made to explain, look, Congress has spoken. This is the law. I can't change the law. It did not sit well with firemen widows or policemen widows who proclaimed, Mr. Feinberg, my husband died a hero. Why am I getting $1 million less than the accountant on the 103rd floor of the World Trade Center? Now, I tried to explain that the notion, the concept of economic loss is well ingrained in America, that this was sort of a substitute, this program, for the tort system, for suing. And in one sort of conceptual sense, it made a lot of sense. But you try telling that to families who have not yet even buried a lost loved one or had a lost loved one vaporized at the World Trade Center, and I must say, it did not sit well for many, many, many months.
What about figuring out a financial formula for compensating for the pain and suffering of the victims and of their families?
Well, the statute required that I add to economic loss the notion of pain and suffering and emotional distress. I realized very early in the program that I could not make distinctions in terms of pain and suffering and emotional distress, and I announced in the regulations everybody who's eligible for a death claim will receive the same amount, $250,000 for the death of the victim and $100,000 for each surviving spouse and dependent. That was it. And I think everybody agreed among the families that it made sense not to make such distinctions on grounds of heroism or on grounds of certain victims surviving longer in the World Trade Center than others. I simply said, I'm not Solomon. I can't make those distinctions. They're invidious. I won't do it. And I set out this basic one-size-fits-all formula.
And everybody seemed comfortable with that.
Well, they were all comfortable with the notion of similarity. They weren't very comfortable with 250,000 and 100,000. They thought, all of them thought that the pain and suffering and emotional distress amount should be four or five times that. But I was unwilling to simply open the U.S. Treasury up to projected wishful amounts, million, 2 million, 3 million, that I would not do.
So what was the final formula for figuring out how much each survivor should get? There was a standard number for to compensate for pain and loss. And what was the formula you came up for compensating for the economic loss of the loved one?
Yes, there was a four-part formula. Part one, I had to calculate economic loss. I had to try in individual cases to predict what a victim would have earned had she or he survived. Second, I had to add to that number non-economic, the standard non-economic pain and suffering, emotional distress that I just spoke about. Then I was required, much to the chagrin of the families, by statute, to deduct from that gross award collateral sources of income, like life insurance. And finally, Congress, in its wisdom, decided, unsure of how the calculations would come out, Congress added a safety valve at the end that said, ultimately, the special master shall exercise his discretion in individual cases to assure justice. And that was basically the four-part statutory formula that I implemented.
Did people ask for special compensation in any cases? And if so, how did you deal with that?
People individually came to see me. I held over 900 individual hearings where families came in, usually claiming unique financial circumstances. And in many cases, I adjusted the awards to take into account these circumstances. And in other cases, I did not. But very important, I invited any individual family or injured victim to come and see me personally, to put a human face on this program and allow them to explain to me in this unique program why adjustments should be made. And I listened carefully and considered those requests and acted on most of them.
Well, what's an example of one of the stories that you were presented with that seemed to rise to the level of being worthy of an adjustment?
Oh, my goodness. The stories are as myriad as human nature. One surviving spouse came to see me and said, Mr. Feinberg, I do hope that you'll find it in your heart to provide a little bit more money. I lost my husband and the World Trade Center, and I have terminal cancer. And I have two little ones at home. And it's not really the death of just one. Soon it will be my death as well. And my children will be orphans. And can you not only give me a little bit more money, but can you expedite the award because I have limited time? That's just one example, heart-wrenching example. But there are hundreds and hundreds of examples.
Do you remember how you resolved the question of how much to compensate this woman who was dying of cancer, having just lost her husband?
Yes, the woman explained, here's what I need, laid out a bill of particulars as to financial concerns going forward for her children, and we examined that and drew some conclusions and increased the award.
Was she satisfied?
I don't think anybody who filed a claim and received a check was satisfied by this process. I think that's the wrong word to use.
I bet you're right.
I think she respected the willingness of the federal government to come to her aid. But I tell people all the time, words like satisfied, justice, fairness, gratefulness, happiness, aren't adjectives that are very helpful in examining this program.
So what finally was the range of figures in the amount of money that was given to families as compensation?
This program spent $7 billion of the taxpayers' money. This was a public compensation program. There was no congressional appropriation. Congress basically delegated to one person whatever it costs to do this right. Authorize it out of general revenues, petty cash at the U.S. Treasury. The range of awards, the average award for a death claim, tax-free by statute, was about $2 million. The death claim awards ranged from a low of about $500,000 to a high of about $7.2 million paid to the family of a 33-year-old stockbroker who died, who was making $3 million a year. The physical injury claims averaged about $400,000, but some of the physical injury claims, and there weren't many physical injury claims on 9/11. You either got out of those buildings in planes or you didn't. But the really serious physical injury claims, burn victims, at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, we paid, in a few cases, over $8 million to people who survived with third-degree burns over 85% of their body, came to see me.
So were you comfortable, finally, with the fact that the family of a stockbroker who was killed was going to get millions of dollars so that they could continue to live the wealthy lifestyle they were accustomed to, and the family of somebody who worked, say, as a maintenance worker in the World Trade Center was going to get a whole lot less?
Well, that's a very provocative question. First of all, I was never comfortable with dispensing any of these awards. Having said that, it's also important to remember that I exercised my discretion in a way so that high-end families, some of whom came in seeking, under the formula, economic loss, $20 or $30 million. I exercised my discretion and substantially brought down the ultimate award number, feeling that under the statute, Congress never wanted any family to get so much that they were going to be able to simply automatically continue a lifestyle with different homes, summer homes, cars in the garage, etc. So at the end of the day, I felt that what I had done was to implement congressional intent. and provide a degree of compensation where an individual family might criticize me or might object, but the award was so generous and so fair that I would withstand any such criticism. And I think ultimately the families realized that.
My guest is Kenneth Feinberg. He served as special master of the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kenneth Feinberg, and he's written a new memoir called What is Life Worth? That's about his experiences as special master in charge of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. Well, we've talked a little bit about how you arrived at the formula for deciding how much money should be given to the families of victims of September 11th. Then you also had to decide who gets the money. What members of the family actually get the money? Or, you know, does somebody who was engaged get the money? Does a same-sex partner who wasn't legally married because they couldn't be get the money? So let's talk a little bit about that. What were the standards, if any, that you were given about how to decide who gets money?
Not one word in the statute about that. Not one. You can look at this statute all day and parse it line by line. You will not find one direction from Congress as to who should file the claim among family members, and who should get the money, very substantial amounts of money, among competing family members. So this proved to be a major problem. Mr. Feinberg, I am a sister of the victim, my brother. My brother hated our other brother. Make sure I get the money and not the hated brother. Mr. Feinberg, I'm the fiancé of the victim. We were going to be married on October 11th. So, you should treat me as a spouse. I was going to be married in a month. Then I would ask the biological parents of the victim, what do you think about that argument? Oh, this marriage was never going to take place. My daughter told me that on September 10th, she was thinking of calling the whole thing off. Then I'd go back to the fiancé. What do you say to that? Is that right? Look, Mr. Feinberg, here's the wedding invitation, right here in the church that we were going to be married. On August 11th, the parents held a shower for me, for the victim, and said, we're not losing a daughter, we're gaining a son. I mean, outrageous, the fiancé would say. Now, what I tried to do is work these problems out. I tried to work them out and get everybody on the same page, and I was usually successful. But I must say, it was a very thorny problem with money of this magnitude trying to get families on the same page.
Did you respect same-sex partnerships in the same way that you would respect marriage when it appeared to you to be, a committed relationship?
Well, I did. If the victim left a will, and in the will left the estate to a same-sex partner, I honored the will. Why wouldn't I? Of course I honored the victim's intention.
What if there wasn't a will? A lot of people didn't have wills.
Now, 80% didn't have wills. These masters of the universe in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon didn't think they needed wills. 80% of people who didn't have wills, I was left with a dilemma. Now what do I do? Well, I did the only thing I think I could do, and that is I followed the law of intestacy in each state of the victim's domicile. And that meant that same-sex partners and fiancés were not entitled by law in any of those states to a share of the award. But I managed, nevertheless, to sit down with would-be recipients of the award. And as I say, through force of argument, emotional, substantive, legal, etc., worked out most of the disputes.
You were appointed by John Ashcroft in, you know, from an administration that does not support gay relationships, certainly not gay marriage. Did you get any flack from the Bush administration for compensating gay partners of victims?
Absolutely not. Not only did I get no flack, remember, I was relying on state law. This was not a federal decision I made in terms of who gets money, same-sex partners, fiancés. I'm looking to the state law of the victim if there's no will. Not only did I get no flack, but I must say, throughout the entire life of the program, Attorney General Ashcroft and the Bush administration were enormously supportive, as was Congress. If you want the best example I know of a truly bipartisan, non-political, apolitical public policy, this was it. I'm extremely grateful for the support that I received from the administration.
Kenneth Feinberg headed the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. His new memoir is called What is Life Worth? He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Summer Guest, a novel of love, family secrets, and a dying man's last wish, by Justin Cronin, author of Mary and O'Neill. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kenneth Feinberg discusses the impact on his own life of heading the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. Also, we meet actor Christian Bale. He's starring in Batman Returns. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kenneth Feinberg. He served as special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. It was his job to create a formula to distribute about $7 billion to the victims of September 11th and the families of those who died. He's written a new memoir called What is Life Worth? Why do you think that John Ashcroft, who was then Attorney General, chose you to head the Victim Compensation Fund?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, and I have the highest admiration and respect for the Attorney General Ashcroft for his support of the program and how much he supported me personally. I'm in his debt, frankly.
Can I interrupt just point out here that you were, years ago, you were an aide to Senator Kennedy, who was much too liberal for the taste of John Ashcroft, so it wasn't your political credentials that made you the choice. Go ahead.
Oh, to the contrary. It was my political credentials that got me the job, in part.
Oh.
As I say in the book, I think one reason that the administration was satisfied with me is because if the program failed, as many thought it would, and caused more divisiveness than hope and help, it could be laid at the feet of a political adversary, or somebody with a political pedigree different from the administration. But I think the main reason I received this appointment is because I had, before 9/11, a good deal of experience in dealing with the design and implementation of mass disaster claims. And I think the administration realized that this was a program that required somebody with some expertise in how to deal with the deaths of thousands of people.
What are some of the ways that your own life has been changed by this experience of heading up the September 11th Victim Compensation Program?
Oh, my life will never be the same. Never be the same. That I'm sure of. I've taken my law firm, which was a very large firm, and after 9/11 just reduced it to bare bones minimum. I don't think I want to practice law the same way anymore after 9/11. I want to teach more. I taught last semester at Columbia Law School and the University of Pennsylvania. And I'm much more fatalistic, I think. I'm not sure I'll plan more than 2 weeks ahead for the rest of my life. People said goodbye on September 11th. It was a beautiful day, a sunny day, perfunctory goodbyes after breakfast. Never saw him again. Not even a body. Vaporized at the World Trade Center. Horrible. And I think that one ought to be a little bit skeptical about planning too far ahead, because life doesn't work that way.
Has the meaning and relative value of money changed for you?
No, I don't think money has really anything to do with it in terms of my, sort of my experience, or at least the residual impact of the program on me personally.
Because the program was all about giving out money.
The program was all about giving out money, of course. And, people should understand that, money can't make anybody whole. It's a poor surrogate in that sense. But I try and remind people when they say this was so un-American that we just gave out money and we gave out different amounts. What happened to equal protection and egalitarianism and democracy? That's wrong. It's just wrong. This program reflected what the civil justice system does every day. If you fall off a ladder and you're a stockbroker, if you get hit by an automobile and you're a stockbroker, you will get more from a jury, money, than if you're a waiter who fell off the ladder or got hit by an automobile. Now, it may be that everybody should get the same amount of money under this program, and I thought that would be better. But it isn't un-American to say that this program worked the way it did. It was very, very American, I would argue.
I bet you have a will.
Everybody should have a will. One lesson from 9/11 is everybody should have a will and leave a record, a formal record, of how you want your estate allocated in the event of unforeseen tragedy.
Even if you don't have much of an estate.
Doesn't matter. One thing I learned about 9/11 Fund, people would come in, and what was so important to many people when they came to see me was not the millions and the millions, but, Mr. Feinberg, I want my wife's locket. Mr. Feinberg, can you help me make sure that I can keep the wedding album? Mr. Feinberg, I want to play you a video of my son's bar mitzvah. Mr. Feinberg, I want you to look at all the medals that my son earned as a fireman before his death. It wasn't all about money. In fact, most of these hearings, amazingly, I learned, were an opportunity for families to just talk, just discuss the memory and the corroboration of that memory in the way of albums and medals and certificates and things like that.
Well, Kenneth Feinberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm very, very honored and pleased that you gave me this opportunity. Thank you very much, Terry.
Kenneth Feinberg headed the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. His new memoir is called What Is Life Worth? Coming up, the star of Batman Begins, Christian Bale. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Batman Begins offers its version of why Bruce Wayne disguised himself in a bat costume to fight injustice and defend the vulnerable. My guest Christian Bale is the star of the film, and he was a pretty unlikely choice. For his previous film, The Machinist, he'd lost over 60 pounds to play a sickly, tormented insomniac. Bale made his film debut at the age of 13, starring in Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun. His other films include American Psycho, Shaft, and Laurel Canyon. Let's start with a scene from Batman Begins. After seeing his parents murdered, Bruce Wayne left Gotham and traveled the world to understand the nature of the criminal mind and to learn martial arts. He returns to Gotham with a plan to fight crime and defend the weak. Here he talks with his faithful butler, played by Michael Caine.
Are you coming back to Gotham for long, sir?
As long as it takes. I'm going to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city.
Did it?
In a way, their murder shocked the wealthy and the powerful into action.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
Christian Bale, welcome to Fresh Air. My first question about Batman is, why you? Yeah, I mean, you haven't been an action hero. You don't have blockbuster status. How did you get the part?
Far from blockbuster status, you know? I think in the film industry, I really haven't had what anybody considers to be a hit, let alone a big hit, really. I have to admit, I was asking the same question myself. It's indicative of the new direction that they wanted to take this Batman. When I met with Chris, I had a very strong opinion about how Batman should be portrayed. He did too. We agreed, and I frankly, I genuinely had no interest in portraying Batman in any other way whatsoever.
What was your idea of how Batman should be portrayed?
He had become, unbeknownst to me, because I was not a comic book fan, he had become a spoof of what Bob Kane had originally intended when he created Batman back in 1939. He was a dark and threatening superhero. He was always the superhero that, in sitting around a table, hanging out with other superheroes, would definitely be the one that the others were kind of looking at sideways and being a little unsure about how quite he got into their group. He also has, obviously, no superhuman powers. The only power that he does have, which is substantial in this world, is enormous wealth, which allows him the time and access to all of the gadgets and the abilities to do what he does. But essentially, what I found in the graphic novels, and there's a great foreword, and I believe it's in Batman Year One by Frank Miller, and it talks about his first experience with Batman, and that to him, Batman was never funny. Batman was dark. And that's really what we've attempted here.
Right before you did Batman, you started in the movie The Machinist, which a film I really liked, and I thought it was a great performance that you gave in that.
Thank you very much.
It was a real nightmarish vision. You play somebody who hasn't slept in a year, and your body is totally emaciated. You're wasted in it, and you're having these delusions, these hallucinations through the movie, and the movie's in black and white, which is the kind of emotional world you're living in. I mean, everything's been drained of life and color. And you're going over the deep end in it. You lost how many pounds for this role?
It ended up being 63 pounds I lost for it.
And I should say that you look like somebody who just got out of a concentration camp or the survivor of a famine in Africa. I mean, you basically have a rib cage and skin.
Yeah, right.
Going that from Batman, you were really pumped up in Batman.
I
mean, your arms, man, they are the size of a lot of people's waists.
Right.
Did you audition as your machinist self for Batman?
Well, that was a conversation that Chris Nolan and I had. We were talking on the telephone whilst I was making The Machinist, and he said to me that I was going to have to screen test for Batman. At the end of July, and this would have been 2003, I weighed 121 pounds. My normal weight averages about 185, 190. And in the first week of September, they had screen tests for Batman planned. So he asked me, well, how did I look? You know, I mean, how was he ever going to be able to convince the studio that I was the man for the job when I was going to be rail thin? And so I really stuffed my face a great deal in those 5-6 weeks. And I managed to put on a pretty substantial amount of weight, no strength whatsoever. But luckily, I didn't have to exhibit any of that for the screen test. And, you know, managed to get by with the test, was cast, but then had a really rigorous, very arduous training period to prepare for Batman, because like we said, this is one without superhuman powers. He must look capable of doing all that he does, and this Batman is grounded in much more reality than any of the previous Batman movies, so we really wanted it to be recognizably believable that he could be a truly good and experienced fighter.
So what's it like to be in the bat suit? I mean, first of all, as an actor, you kind of lose your face as a tool because it's covered
by the mask. You have your
eyes, though.
You know, you have your eyes with this. You have your eyes and your mouth and obviously the body language as well, which I think is so crucial with playing any kind of an outfit like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very, it is very constricting. The cowl certainly is extremely tight, you know, as it must be. And I did find myself having pretty splitting headaches after 2 or 3 hours within it. I'd chosen to play the role. I wasn't going to be complaining about it. And I chose instead to kind of use that because I saw Batman, the creature, as being somebody who would probably have a very focused and intense headache that would be putting me in quite a rage and quite a mood. So I just used it.
We've talked a little bit about how you lost a lot of weight for The Insomniac Machinist, your previous movie. You put on weight and pumped up for Batman. And in another earlier movie, American Psycho, you had the kind of muscles that a real narcissist might have, somebody who pumps up because of the way it looks, not because he necessarily
needs
strength.
Well, thank you for recognizing the difference in that, because absolutely, with American Psycho, it was all about the vanity, the narcissism. It was nothing to do with health, really. Whereas with Batman, it was, you know, meant to look like a genuine brawler, somebody who did truly have athletic capabilities.
So you've had several different, like extremely different bodies. for your movies, do you lose sight at any point about what your actual body is?
No, you always kind of level out back to, you know, my normal self. That always just comes back regardless of my efforts.
And like, what happens to all the muscles you put on for Batman? Do you have to keep working out to keep them, or do you expect to lose
them?
No,
because that would be limiting. You know, I mean, if I was to maintain that look, then that would be firstly a huge commitment in my own life, which I don't feel the need for, and secondly would be limiting in terms of other roles that. That I can take. I'm actually starting again to nothing to the degree of The Machinist, but to lose some weight for another role that I'm going to be doing in a movie that's going to be directed by Werner Herzog, which we start in a few months. And so, you know, I'm making another adjustment now. I don't ever look at parts and hope that will be the case. It's just been that, you know, with American Psycho, with The Machinist, and with Batman, that it's really been, to me, very pertinent to the character that they have that certain kind of physique. It's been essential.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christian Bale, and he stars in the new movie Batman Begins. You were born in Wales. How many countries did you grow up in?
Well, there was Wales, and then I moved houses many times within England, primarily in England. Briefly, my family kind of ran away to Portugal for about a year, and I was there for a few months. And then from the age of 17 onwards, I started really to call America my home much more.
Before you started acting in movies and you got your first really big role, I think you were 12 when you got your role in Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun. But you were doing commercials before that. What kind of commercials were you doing?
I'd done a couple. You know, I did these kind of embarrassing commercials which were fun. You know, for somebody of 10 years old, it gave me the money to buy a pair of Doc Martens and a Rubik's snake or something, which is what I was into at the time. And other than that, though, it was really just kind of amateur theater groups that I belonged to.
So, what did you do for the audition for Empire of the Sun? You know, what did you do to land such a big role with so little experience? And I should mention no actual training behind you.
No. I had played a role in a mini TV series which Amy Irving had been in.
She was
married to Steven Spielberg at that time. However, he told me that he really disliked my performance in that. But you know, they were doing mass auditions around England for Empire of the Sun. I met a number of people just coincidentally who said, "Oh, we auditioned for that as well." You know, it was thousands of schools that they were going around looking for people. And I did a series of auditions culminating, you know, in meeting with Spielberg and doing a screen test and then getting the part. And you know, I think that much of what got me the part was that I didn't much care. I enjoyed the process. I'd always actually enjoyed the acting, but I never really considered it at that age. Certainly not. It would have been very unhealthy to be thinking of it as a long-term career. And so I think it was precisely that kind of devil-may-care attitude that probably got me the role.
My guest is Christian Bale, the star of Batman Begins. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christian Bale. He's the star of the new movie Batman Begins. His other films include Empire of the Sun, American Psycho, Laurel Canyon, and The Machinist. A question about American Psycho, in which you play someone who works on Wall Street. He's quite the narcissist. You know, very attractive, fine suits, great like lotions and shampoos and restaurants and all that stuff. But he also gets turned on by killing. And there's one scene in the movie where you're naked and covered in blood chasing a woman with a chainsaw. why'd you take the role? You know, the book got such better. The book was just kind of shredded by a lot of critics.
Right.
And then it was criticized by a lot of people for moral reasons because your character is such a sociopath.
Yes.
So why did you want to jump into this one?
I had not read the book before reading the script. And I was anticipating, because I had been aware of the controversy surrounding the book, and I had read I'd read maybe a couple of pages of it. I was expecting something very different from the script. And what I found is that I may well have a peculiar sense of humor, but that I was crying with laughter in reading the script. Because to me, the character of Patrick Bateman was always an absolutely ridiculous one. You know, he's laughable. And to me, it was never really a movie about a serial killer. That was this extreme that Bret Easton Ellis had pushed it to. But really, it was a social satire about a yuppie in the 80s. And that was the way that Mary Harron, who wrote the script, had adapted it. And so much of the violence, which is contained in the book in an incredibly graphic manner, is merely suggested in the movie. And I think, therefore, that you can appreciate much more the black comedic sense of humor throughout the movie. Because I think that the book, the violent scenes were so graphic that you ended up forgetting that there was actually a great deal more to the book, because those particular violent scenes were just too graphic to bear at times.
Now, there's some voiceovers in American Psycho, and I want to play one of the voiceovers. And this is a scene from early on in which you're enumerating all the wonderful, you know, like lotions and shampoos and things that you have. I mean, you really are the ultimate narcissist in this movie. Here's that voiceover.
I always use an aftershave lotion with little or no alcohol because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look older. Then moisturizer, then an anti-aging eye balm followed by a final moisturizing protective lotion. There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
No, I think we can hear in that, in this voiceover from American Psycho, you have this perfect, mid-America, like TV announer,
right.
kind of voice. You're from Wales.
Yeah.
How did you get that voice? And you have very few traces now, I think, of a Welsh accent.
Well, my voice I can kind of change at will. With every character that I've played, it's very easy just to pick that accent or dialect back up again. And for me specifically right now, I'm talking primarily about Batman Begins, and I feel that he's such an American icon that I chose not to be doing interviews in my full-blown English accent. I felt that it would just be raising too many questions.
Well, really, are you just you mean you're kind of like performing the interview in a way, like you're doing it in a voice?
Well, listen, I've played more American characters than I've ever played English, and I tend to maintain whatever accent I'm doing throughout a movie. So in honesty, it's become as natural for me to speak in that way as it is in my, you know, home tongue. So it's just a choice, you know. But yeah, I made the decision that when talking about Batman, I didn't wish to sound English, you know. I realized that he's such a strongly identified American icon that I just didn't want to raise that question.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Christian Bale stars in the new movie Batman Begins. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage, from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio. I met her
in a nightclub over on the Lower East Side. On the next Fresh Air, Delbert McClinton. He started performing in the 50s, playing Texas honky tonks, and backing up performers like Howlin' Wolf, Big Joe Turner, and Sonny Boy Williamson. That set off a rocky but enduring 5-decade career in music. Join us for the next Fresh Air.